Again, those prophecies of restoration not only spoke of the restoring of Jerusalem, but certainly of Christ building his church. Our text today is Ezra chapter 6, verses 13 to 22, as we continue on in our study of that particular book. Then, because of the decree of King Darius had said to Tanai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar Boznai, and their associates, carried it out with diligence. So all the elders of the Jews continued to build and prosper under the preaching of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah, descendant of Iddo. They finished building the temple according to the command of the God of Israel and the decrees of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, kings of Persia. The temple was completed on the third day of the month Adar and the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. Then the people of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the exiles celebrated the dedication of the house of God with joy. For the dedication of this house of God, they offered 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 male lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats, one for each tribe of Israel. And they installed the priests in their divisions and the Levites in their groups for the service of God at Jerusalem, according to what was written in the book of Moses. On the 14th day of the first month, the exiles celebrated the Passover. The priests and the Levites had purified themselves and were all ceremonially clean. The Levites slaughtered the Passover lamb for the exiles, for their brothers, the priests, and for themselves. So the Israelites, who had returned from the exile, ate it together with all who had separated themselves from the unclean practices of their Gentile neighbors in order to seek the Lord, the God of Israel. For 7 days they celebrated with joy the Feast of Unleavened Bread because the Lord had filled them with joy by changing the attitude of the king of Assyria so that he assisted them in the work on the house of God of Israel. Now what you do in times of extreme high or extreme low can say a lot about you. When you're celebrating, whatever it is that you're celebrating, is the praise of God part of the mix? Is praising God on your lips in that situation? When you're on the verge of despair, do you find yourself pouring your heart out to God or raging against others? The priority of worship in the minds of these returned exiles is remarkable, and a grand lesson for us to keep worship foremost in our thoughts. Well, the officials got down to work on the temple, and understandably so, given those harsh sanctions of Darius that we talked about last week, not just because they didn't want to be the guy that would be impaled or have his house destroyed, because this was their heart's desire. They wanted the temple built. They wanted their worship to be full in every way. And the work now seems to be moving on quite smoothly with the government's approval. The Jews benefited from and were encouraged by the preaching of Haggai and Zechariah. We actually have a sample of some of Zechariah's preaching. If you want to turn there, it's found in chapter 4. I'm just going to read you a few verses, starting at verse 6 of Zechariah 4. So he said to me, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord Almighty. What are you, O mighty mountain? Before Zerubbabel you'll become level ground. Then he will bring out the capstone to shouts of, 'God bless it, God bless it.' Then the word of the Lord came to me, 'The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this temple. His hands will also complete it. Then you will know that the Lord Almighty has sent me to you. Who despises the day of small things? Men will rejoice when they see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel.'" Let's just think on what he said there for a little bit. Very common passage there, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, something we hear a lot. But if you take that and you run the history of Israel through that idea, you can see it. When they turned to might and power, where did they go? Most often off a cliff somewhere, making deals with Egypt or making deals with these guys or those guys. never led to a good place. When they were led by the Spirit of God, they prospered. But might and power have often been opposed to God's people. And we have to know that when He works on their behalf, there's no resisting His plan. God will work by His Spirit. He will rebuild this temple, and that is a grand picture and type of His building of the church in our day. Now, this is the error of many when they think that the ordinary things, the ordinary means of grace are not sufficient, that we have to find new strategies, we have to pick up on the next latest thing and that sort of thing. No, the Holy Spirit works through the proclamation of His Word, through the celebration of His sacraments, through the fellowship of His people. The ordinary things is where He is at work. Just as He was at work in the everyday labors of Zerubbabel and his crew, pick up this stone and put it there, then get the next one and put it there. ESV translates it a little bit differently at chapter 4, verse 7. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel you shall become a plain. And he shall bring forward the top stone with shouts of grace, grace to it. It's a little different flavor. Makamiski, the commentator, said this, the assurance continues as the words of God anticipate the temple's completion. Zerubbabel will lead the laborers in a festal celebration. Some of them will position the wooden rollers beneath the capstone, while others strain at its ropes. The laborers only have to lift it into place and square it with the other stones to complete the work. It is significant that the people attribute the work to God by crying, grace, grace, as this is going on. And they say it to the stone, grace, grace. They do not celebrate their own abilities or national might, for they had little of that. The people learned of the mighty power of the Holy Spirit at their disposal. Verse 9, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this temple. His hands will also complete it. Then you will know that the Lord Almighty has sent you. The completion of the temple, he's saying, is going to be proof of God's revelation. Notice again, though, the importance of human agency. God is at work, but He is at work through Zerubbabel and the other builders that are working with them. But seriously, with preaching like that, it's no wonder the Jews were motivated to complete this work and to do so with real joy. Kidner, that I've quoted numerous times in this series, said the temple was finished by the last month of 516. Only 4.5 years after Haggai's first call to action. So this venture of faith, begun in hard times, and he notes there Haggai 1, 6 to 11, and continued in a day of small things, Zechariah 4, 10, and of ominous investigations, Ezra 5, 3, it ended in triumph. It was also, though nothing is made of it here, roughly 70 years since the destruction of Solomon's temple. So the 70 years were prophesied, and after 70 years, they're raising the capstone in place and shouting, grace, grace. Now, once it's completed, they have a dedication service. And Solomon did the same thing for the original temple. He did it on a very grand scale. And you have to remember that Solomon's day, at the time of the building of the temple, was the very pinnacle of Israel as a nation. It was when they were their most successful, their most wealthy. This dedication, though seriously joyous, was by a nation that was still a vassal of a pagan king. Kids, let me talk to you for a second. Let me go around this side. Last week, we did something very special right here. Who remembers what it was? Somebody over here does. What did we do here last week? That's right. David's baptism. Well, baptism is sort of like a dedication. It's more than a dedication, but it is saying that this child we recognize as a gift of God, and we want to present this child to God as His. He really is God's child, and God gives him to us to to raise and to train and to deal with as God's gift. So he's dedicated to God, although he also becomes a member of us as the people of faith. But dedications still go on today. Lots of different kinds of dedications. We're going to learn about the dedication that they did back in Jerusalem. So keep listening a little bit and see if you can pick up some of what happened at that dedication. Now, some of the dedications that we find in the Old Testament aren't necessarily called that, but in fact they are. One of the earliest we find in Genesis 28. Jacob was on his way to Haran to find a wife. God appeared to him in a dream. And Jacob saw that famous stairway to heaven, sometimes called Jacob's ladder, and he reconfirmed the covenant to him there as he had to Abraham and Isaac. Listen to what Jacob does in the morning after he wakes up. Verse 16. When Jacob woke from his sleep, he thought, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I wasn't aware of it." He was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. It's the gate of heaven." Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone that he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on it. And he called that place Bethel, though the city used to be called Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and all of you and of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth." So he has a worship experience right there out in the middle of the wilderness, sets up this stone, and he dedicates it to God. It became a sacred place now. Similarly, on God's instruction, every firstborn, because of the plague against the firstborn in Egypt, every firstborn of the Jews was to be dedicated to God, whether human or animal. And then there were various laws given for the redemption of a firstborn. In the books of Leviticus and Numbers, there are numerous rules for dedication of a house, dedication of land, dedication of hair, that was relative to the Nazirite vow. The altar was dedicated, the tabernacle was dedicated. In 2 Samuel 8, we read this: Joram brought with him the articles of silver and gold and bronze. King David dedicated these articles to the Lord as he had done with silver and gold from all the nations he had subdued. So the plunder and the spoils of war are brought and dedicated to God. So this idea of a dedication is nothing new. Probably the grandest dedication of all was the dedication of Solomon's temple. We read about it in 2 Chronicles 7. When Solomon finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. The priests could not enter the temple of the Lord because the glory of the Lord filled it. When all the Israelites saw the fire coming down and the glory of the Lord above the temple, they knelt on the pavement with their faces to the ground. They worshipped and gave thanks to the Lord, saying, "He is good. His love endures forever." Then the king and all the people offered sacrifices before the Lord. King Solomon offered a sacrifice of 22,000 heads of cattle and 120,000 sheep and goats. The king and all the people dedicated the temple to God. So given all of that history, it was a natural thing for the Jews to want to dedicate this now rebuilt temple to God. He was the one who had them restore it. It would have seemed a rather ungodly thing to go on without a dedication. Now, this one, as I said, would not be on the scale of that one that Solomon did. The celebration was very much dependent on the generosity of Darius. He gave them the stuff to do it. So this comparatively humble list of sacrifices given in the text, but it's still a lot. Think about it. Verse 17, we're back to our text now, by the way. For the dedication of this house of God, they offered 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 male lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats, one for each of the tribes. It's still a lot. We might ask, why all this bloodshed? Why so many animals, even in this small scale dedication service? Well, sacrifice was a primary means of connection to God. They, as a people, related to God safely on the basis of the blood of an innocent victim. Sacrifice was set in motion by God Himself in the garden right after the fall and was a requirement for His people down through history. It became codified in the law with what was required in the various sacrifices. It was a graphic way of showing the depths of sin and the glory and worthiness of God. These folks were quite aware of their sinful condition as a nation. And why wouldn't they be? They just spent 70 years in exile for what they had done. They were now profoundly grateful to God, and hence this great display of affection for Him and for a display of His glory for them. So they were profoundly grateful to God. In reality, dedication is merely offering something to God of which He is worthy. It also includes in it just a huge pile of gratitude for what He has done. And they were grateful for bringing Him back to the land, for seeing to it that the altar was rebuilt, seeing to it now that the temple was rebuilt, the capstone in place. They called out to it, grace, grace, and now they celebrate this dedication. At the same time, they held an installation service. They installed the priests in their divisions, the Levites in their groups, for the service of God at Jerusalem, according to what was written in the law of Moses. Now, the division of labor between priests and Levites and the various, they were divided into 24 divisions and all that sort of thing. Some of that comes from Moses. The actual dividing into a roster was developed by David, but they did what was required. They got the people in place. So now they not only had an altar, they had a complete temple with a properly functioning priesthood, and they had all of the Levite attendants necessary to make the temple run well. In all of this, there's not a word about the Ark of the Covenant. That caused you to wonder anything? Well, we don't really know what happened to it. Most assume that it was either lost or destroyed. Probably when the temple was sacked and destroyed, it was taken. Probably the gold scraped off of it, the wooden box most likely destroyed. Although there is a legend that Jeremiah took it and hid it in the desert. And hence, stories arise out of that legend, like Indiana Jones and things like that. There's I don't know if it's much of a possibility or not, but there's a small little monastery in Ethiopia where they claim they have it inside their building. Of course, the only one that can get in there is a member of that order. So no one can get in to confirm whether or not they have it or not. So we don't really know. I think the most probable thing is that the gold was scraped off and it was destroyed and it's gone forever. But here again is another consequence of sin, isn't it? They were forgiven. They were restored. But they don't have the ark. Above all, that was the real symbol of God's presence with them. Now we know that God was still with them even in this restoration, but this most precious and sacred item was lost due to their national sins, maybe never to be regained. So even in their great celebration, there's a reminder of the cost of their sin. Well, a few weeks after the dedication, it's time for the Passover. Still a prominent festival among Jews today. In order to celebrate it, you had to be ceremonially clean. So the priests and the Levites saw to it that they themselves were properly prepared for the festival. And then the people prepared themselves as well. And there were certainly some who couldn't participate. out of no fault of their own, either through contact with a dead body or contact with blood or something like that that made them ceremonially unclean. But those able to participate made sure they were clean and able to do it. Look at verse 21. So the Israelites who had returned from exile ate it together with all those who had separated themselves from the unclean practices of their Gentile neighbors in order to seek the Lord, the God of Israel. So you get the sense, at least it's the way I read it, that the Samaritans that were there, some of them also went through whatever was necessary to be ceremonially clean. And they separated themselves from the pagan practices, and they participated as well. Now, even though they were not permitted to participate in the rebuilding of the temple, yet when the temple is now ready and functional, they're invited in. So most of these were most likely from that group of Jews that was left behind when the others were taken off in exile. So they had Jewish roots of some sort. There certainly could have been others who were not of Jewish descent, but who decided after seeing all that what's going on, hey, we're gonna serve Yahweh too. So they separated themselves in order to partake of the celebration. So it was open to all who would humble themselves before the Lord. Passover was intended to remind the Jews of their dependence on God and who celebrate the deliverance that was theirs in the Exodus. God was the one who delivered them from slavery and from bondage. Now that's a good precedent for us about the nature of the church. There are to be no barriers relative to ethnicity or economics or anything of that sort. No, all are welcome. There is a requirement, however, that people be submitted to God. There's a requirement of faith rather than a requirement of all the other kinds of walls that we tend to build. An unclean Jew or a non-Jew that had not separated himself from paganism wasn't welcome at the feast. So it was a matter of heart, a matter of faith in God rather than physical lineage. We're told the celebration went on for 7 days. That too was prescribed by the Lord through Moses. This was a celebration of grace and deliverance. As slaves in Egypt, the Israelites had no options. They couldn't muster an army. They had nothing. And they were up against the most powerful nation in the world at the time. There was no way in their strength that they could have delivered themselves. It was all by the grace of God. The official festival was then centered on the grace of God in the delivery of from slavery. And now add to that God's work in bringing them back to the land, moving the hearts of kings and all sorts of things for the purpose of rebuilding. They had a whole lot to celebrate. Reasons to rejoice. Perhaps we need to comment on why the king here is referred to as the king of Assyria. When you read that, did that make you scratch your head? Well, some think it's a scribal error, that when the scribe was copying the text, he just wrote the wrong name in. That is a possibility, but I doubt it. Most likely, Assyria was the original oppressor. They were the ones who came through and took the first batch of exiles out. They were then absorbed by the Babylonians. Babylonians then absorbed by the Medo-Persians. And there's a connection from the present-day Persians back to the Assyrians 100 or so years before. But the Persians themselves referred to that geographical region as Assyria. And the nation today of Syria, that's just a shortened form of Assyria. So there's still a connection of referring to that section of real estate there as Assyria. So very well could be that the king would be referred to as the king of Assyria because he was king of that land as well as all of the Medo-Persian Empire. Now we celebrate all three of these sermon points each week when we gather here. We rejoice in the fact that the work of Christ is complete. when he said, "Tetelestai, it is finished." We can rest in the fact that all that was necessary for us and for our salvation was accomplished by Christ in his life and death and resurrection. It's done. So we celebrate completion, just like they did the completion of the temple. There's no longer a physical temple where the Lord dwells, but rather he has taken up residence in our hearts, in the heart of every believer. We now are the temple of God, both individually and corporately. His temple can never be assailed again by the evil one because Christ's work is complete. We gather here each week to rededicate ourselves to our Savior. We come to hear his pledge of covenant renewal to us. And rather than dedicating a building, we offer ourselves to him as willing subjects. We do that when we confess our sin and hear his pledge of forgiveness, by confessing our faith, and by seeking to serve him throughout another week. And finally, in a sense, we also celebrate the Passover. We acknowledge that the Lord's Supper is linked to the Passover, but not exactly the same. It's not the Passover we celebrate, but there's a link to it. It was instituted by Jesus with the disciples right after the Passover was celebrated. And so there's clearly a connection. In it, we recall the sacrifice of Christ for our deliverance, just as the Jews celebrated their emancipation from slavery. But there's more here than just remembrance. There's a connection to Christ here. There is a union or fellowship in the body and blood of Christ. We feed on him spiritually in a similar fashion that the Jews consumed the Passover lamb. Paul wrote this in Corinthians, "Get rid of the old yeast, that you may be a new batch without yeast, as you really are. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us keep the festival, not with the old yeast, the yeast of malice and wickedness, but with the bread without yeast, the bread of sincerity and truth." So Christ is indeed our Passover. The angel of death brought its affliction on him in order to pass over us. So let's rededicate ourselves to God every day to serve him and one another. Let's recognize that Christ's work is complete. We cannot add to it, take away from it. It's done, and it's done for us. So then let's live in obedience to God out of sheer gratitude for what he's accomplished. I'm sure that was the attitude of these Jews, at least at this point. Later chapters we'll find out things weren't quite so hunky-dory, but right now they were living in overwhelming gratitude for what God had done. And now, centuries later, let's celebrate the completed work of Christ. Let's dedicate ourselves to him and to his church. Let's celebrate the new Passover. We will not face the destroying wrath of God because Christ bore that penalty in his own body on the cross. We have a real Passover here to celebrate. Let's do so now.